Welcome to this episode of the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum, the leading authority on cyber, information security, and risk management. I'm Tavia Gilbert, and I'm glad to welcome you back to another cutting-edge conversation tailored to CISOs, CTOs, CROs, and other global security pros. In every episode of ISF's media, Managing Director Steve Durbin speaks with rule breakers, collaborators, culture builders, and business creatives who manage their enterprises with vision, transparency, authenticity, and integrity. And he brings that conversation to you, your teams, and your partners. Today, Steve is in conversation with Dr. Hannah Fry, Associate Professor in the Mathematics of Cities at the Center for Advanced Spatial Analysis at University College London, and a researcher in the patterns of human behavior, particularly in an urban setting. In this conversation, Steve and Hannah discuss the challenge and imperative of communicating across demographics with simplicity and clarity, the power of storytelling, the moral tensions inherent in data mining, and more. And now, Steve and Dr. Hannah Fry.
Hannah, thanks very much for coming along to chat. Hello World, your latest book that's just been produced, this expresses and explains some of the emerging complexities, really, around technology, I would say, in a fairly simple and easy to understand way, which I think is the real beauty of it. My question is, we've got a number of chief information security officers, security people watching and listening to this. What advice can you give them to really get across some of, what I have to say, some quite complex messages in here, but in a very simple, very readable way? So how can a CISO replicate that into a conversation with a business leader or a board member?
Oh, how can they get complicated ideas over across in a simple way, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, with difficulty. there's a note in the back of that book which says that I didn't so much write that book as drag it out of myself while kicking and screaming, sometimes literally. And I think that is, it's really hard, right? It's really hard, especially when you are surrounded in an environment where people speak the same language as you. It's very difficult to step out of that and not use buzzwords and not use jargon and really simplify the ideas. And so it took me a long time, really. I mean, I'm pleased that you picked up on that because that was really one of my biggest objectives. But this now, I think once you work out how to do it, actually, it is a skill that, well, that you can apply, you know, almost automatically once you've worked out how to do it. But also I think the skill, you know, really applies in a lot of situations. So I'm thinking here in terms of, because I do a lot of work with the BBC, mm-hmm. and I often have to interview academics, right, about their work. And you know within about 20 seconds of them talking whether they are able to do it or not. And I think really ultimately the real tip is that you just have to imagine that you are actually speaking to a five-year-old. So not in a patronising way, but the language that you use, it's all about drawing analogies wherever you can, mm-hmm. all about pulling out the grand patterns of what you're talking about, the sort of the main shapes rather than the detail. But beyond that, I mean, I think ultimately it's just about practising.
I think the thing that struck me was that you were telling a story and you had lots of different vignettes within it. Mm. So stories within stories, but ultimately you're telling a story, and that really is the art, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's all about the hook, all about the hook. So John Ronson, he says that you should look for tabloid headlines, but then treat the story as though you were a serious academic. And I think that's generally true. So, I mean, there's stuff in there about, I don't know, people driving their cars off a cliff, or there's one quite salacious story about a woman finding some things in her Tesco favourites section of her club card that her husband had bought that he really should not have been buying. I mean, there's quite a lot of sort of very salacious stories, if you like, in there. But you're right. As humans, we are naturally inclined towards storytelling. And I think if you can make your point in a story, and then once you have someone's attention, that is when you hit them with what you actually want them to know. Show them rather than tell them. Show them first and then tell them afterwards.
One of the stories that you go into in here is, of course, the one around Cambridge Analytica, which everyone is probably familiar with. Do you have concerns about the way that data obviously was used in that instance, but is still being used today?
Yes. Yes, but I'm almost, yes, but depressingly, I'm almost giving up. I think if people were aware of just how far things have gone in terms of our data, just how much is known about us, just how much is inferred about us, I think it's really shocking, right? I mean, okay, so there was a federal report, this is a couple of years ago now, so maybe 2016 or so, which looked at data brokers, mm-hmm. so people whose entire business is based on the idea of collecting data about individuals, categorising it, and then selling it on. So somewhere in the world, there is a file with your name on it, mm-hmm. and in that file will be some record of all of the things that you've done online. So in that file, there are things like, you know, standard stuff like your sex, your age, your income bracket, you know, your ethnicity, that kind of thing. But also things like whether you've ever had an abortion, if you're a woman, whether you're gay, your true sexuality and your claimed sexuality, as it were, whether there's a difference between the two, how risk-taking you are, whether you've ever used drugs. I mean, all of these things can be inferred about us. And I think that this is something that is currently very invisible to us. And I can't help but feel as though, I always think about drones when it comes to this. You know, when drones were first around, they'd pop up everywhere, right? You go to the park and people would be flying them around and then you'd fly over your house. And it was really annoying. You go to the beach and there'd just be drones everywhere. And quite quickly, we brought in regulations and legislation to stop that from happening because it was just, people just felt really uncomfortable with it. And I can't help but think that the way that data is used, save for a few bits of regulation like GDPR, actually, we are unprotected against the worst excesses of it because it's invisible to us, and so we're not outraged by it in quite the same way.
I think that's certainly a challenge that a lot of security people face because, you know, we have the challenge of just raising awareness and then really, as you point out, it's very difficult to see a breach unless you have actually been, you've lost data yourself or you know somebody who has been under attack. It's very difficult to imagine what that is actually like. You talk about GDPR, privacy. That's an issue that continually bubbles around. Different perspectives on it in different parts of the world, obviously. But how do you see privacy and that central issue of our data being ours as opposed to somebody else? How do you see that evolving, perhaps in a sort of algorithm-driven world that we're in?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different suggestions for what to do with it. I mean, I think that it's important here to point out that in many ways I'm a complete hypocrite, right? Because actually, a lot of the work that I do thrives on the use of data.
Right.
And there are some data sets where, you know, the idea of having access to them fills me with total glee, but the idea of being part of them fills me with horror, right? You know, and I think it's important to be honest about that. I'm thinking in particular, there was one project in Bristol. This is from a couple of years ago, where they rigged up a house with every possible sensor you could imagine, right? So they could tell when you opened and closed the fridge door, when you turned on and off a tap, all of this stuff. And the objective really was that if you had a relative who was perhaps ill or disabled or had dementia, that you could use the technology to ensure that they were continuing to follow their daily routine without, you know, being invasive in terms of their privacy. And that data, when I remember speaking to these academics and talking about that data, and I was like, oh my God, I would love to have, imagine if you had even just 100 people, mm-hmm. data from everything they did in their home, imagine, it'd be amazing. But would I want to be part of it? Absolutely not, no way at all. But I think that that's really the tension here, right, is that there is this often conflicting battle between innovation, between wanting to understand how people work, wanting to improve science and medicine, wanting to get a better data-driven and evidence-based view of the world and of our future. And that is often in conflict with the rights of an individual and the privacy that I think we should all be well entitled to. So I think going forward, there are a couple of ways around that tension, I think, that are interesting. The first, which was proposed a few years ago, which is sort of, you know, a bit, I'm not sure it would work in practice, but was the idea that you would have some kind of intermediary, like a bank, right? Like which the bank holds your data on your behalf, and where your data earns money, you earn some interest from it. And I kind of like that idea that then it's you're the one who owns it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's realistic. I think a probably more realistic version of the future is this idea of differential privacy. So that, you know, this is what companies like Apple have moved into a lot. So, you know, the Apple photos on your phone, they don't leave your phone, and yet the software can still detect a face, can still detect all of these different kind of things. And it's because they're extracting sort of top-level statistics, top-level characteristics of your data so that you can still do the analysis while preserving people's privacy. And I think that the more people that get behind that version of the future, I think that's where I'd like to see us go.
Well, one of the other concerns that I certainly have, just building on that, is around the manipulation of data. And at the ISF, we produce a Threat Horizon report every year, where we talk about different threats. And in one of our more recent ones, we talked about the threat associated with fake news, and more recently, we highlighted the problem of deepfakes. How do you see the market, if you like, for such fakery developing, and what can we actually do to address it?
In a lot of ways, the thing about deepfakes, actually, video is that last frontier. You know, we've been able to have, we've had fake audio for a while. I mean, you can just use an impressionist, right? Yeah. If you want fake audio. Fake photographs as well, we've had those too. And so video, of course, is the final frontier. But I think that actually, well, I like to hope that the, you know, there are still ways that you can tell that something is fake, right? These things aren't quite perfect yet. And they're sort of giveaway clues within the frame itself that allow you to tell whether it's fake. And so I hope that actually we will learn to apply the same sort of skepticism to video footage as we do currently with photography. I mean, it's all the same thing, right? Like, I'd really like us to go for trusted sources more. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same battle, right? Fake news, deepfakes, and so on. I do also think, though, there is actually a sort of positive side to deepfakes too, which is this idea that, say you really love the Spice Girls, right? And you look like the sort of man who does.
I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or not.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What Spice would you be? You can think of what Spice you would be. But, you know, with the opportunity of deepfakes, you can create, for example, incredibly immersive VR games where you are immersed in a world, and to your left you have Sporty Spice, to your right you have Baby Spice, and you're standing on stage in front of thousands of people singing one of their songs, doing all the dance moves, right? And this is something that is actually, you know, all photorealistic. And I think that, you know, there are sort of positive applications of this technology as well as just the bad stuff.
I don't know if that's a particularly positive image that you've created for most
it.
People, but we take that one stage further. Let's talk about artificial intelligence, AI. AI is going to present us with a whole range, potentially anyway, of deeply troubling choices that we have to make. And the example that you pull out in the book is that of driverless cars and the element of choice around the algorithms used, which may choose between, for instance, saving the life of the driver versus, you know, saving as many other lives as possible in the case of an accident. That's a huge human dilemma, isn't it? How are we going to be able to deal with such choices in the future?
Well, it's a big one, isn't it? OK, so I should tell you that there's a really interesting study. I think I wrote about this in my book. I don't know if it made the cut in the end, but there's a really interesting... Some people did a questionnaire where they said to a whole host of individuals, what do you think a car should do? Kill the people on board or kill the people in the street? And everyone said it should kill the fewest number of people. So it should kill the person in the car. So I was like, OK, fine, right? We know that that's what the future should hold. And then a follow-up question was, would you buy a car that killed the driver in a situation like that? And everyone was like, absolutely no. No way. Definitely wouldn't. No way whatsoever. And so I sort of think in a lot of ways, these questions, these big questions, are going to be driven by the economics of the situation rather than necessarily... I'd like there to be a panel of people discussing the ethics of these different things. But I think that up until now, we haven't really seen that. We've had the economics driving the direction as we go ahead. I should tell you, actually, that that thing you're describing there is known as the trolley problem. And it was devised, I think, in the 1970s. And the whole point of it was to demonstrate that sometimes you are faced with an impossible problem, a problem that doesn't have an easy answer. And I think the whole thing about artificial intelligence and, you know, machine learning in general is that these are machines that look for straightforward, clear and simple answers. And inevitably, you're going to find a problem where you try and put that in a situation of where ethics is a real concern and where actually there isn't a right answer to be had.
And I think some people would say we're starting to see some of that at the moment in the way that the pandemic is being handled. We hear so often that politicians are following the science, they're following the data. But actually, it's the interpretation of the data where the real value lies, right? It's not just in the data per se, that's just an input into it, and we have to consider a whole range of other things, as in the example you've just been quoting there. So how do we ensure that we can try to get this balance between vast amounts of information that we do have to sift through, where AI can certainly help, machine learning can certainly help, mathematicians can certainly help.
Thanks.
And also balance it up, though, with some of these human choices that we inevitably are going to have to make.
Oh, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I think actually that point that you made a moment ago about following the science, I think that is ultimately the real key here. Because I would say it's not possible to follow the science. I would say it's not possible to have data decide the answers for you. I would say that it's not possible to have machine learning or artificial intelligence to dictate what path we should follow. All of those things, all that they can do is to lay out potential trajectories of the future. And it has to be a human at the top of it all who understands context, who understands nuance, who chooses the path ahead to follow. I think that that's one thing I've really noticed this year is that there is this fundamental misunderstanding of what science is for, if you like, that neglects the incredibly important role of creating a partnership between humans and machines, rather than thinking of one as a replacement for the other.
Hannah Fry, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation with Dr. Fry, who leaves us on that closing note, a reminder that data and technology can be powerful tools for human good, as long as human decision-making and humanity are at their heart. In our next episode, Steve speaks with Bridget Schulte, the New York Times best-selling author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, the founding director of the Good Life Initiative and the director of the Better Life Lab. Steve and Bridget discuss the powerful opportunities for remeasuring values, opportunities that have revealed themselves during the disruption of the global workplace. Here's a preview of that conversation with Bridget Schulte.
This is a time to think beyond the balance sheet. And the intangibles are actually, you know, the sort of the soft things are the most important things right now. Health and well-being, communication, all those soft skills that don't necessarily show up in those profit and loss statements. And yet, those are the things that will have an enormous impact on your productivity, on your culture, and on whether you're going to not only weather this crisis, but move beyond it and thrive.
We look forward to bringing you the full interview. In the meantime, we invite you to tune into our catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. If you feel like today's conversation was of value, you can subscribe to the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be so grateful if you'd recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you these timely discussions. You can always join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page at linkedin.com/company/information-security-forum, or get in touch directly through our website, where you can also download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like these. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Assistant producer, Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.